Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we are diving beneath the headlines today on the biggest story of the week here in Greater Boston, and that is undoubtedly the white supremacist march that shattered the 4th of July weekend in Boston. Up to 100 masked marchers from a known white supremacist group descended on the city, apparently to the surprise of police and city officials. Activist Charles Morrell, who is black, says marchers attacked them near Copley Square. Boston Herald photographer Stuart Cahill captured the moment. Now, in the week since, Morrell has demurred from sharing that experience, speaking about it publicly only sparingly at press conferences. Morrell was set to join us today, but just a few minutes ago decided to hold off. We hope to connect with them on Monday. But we do have analysts with us to help make sense of what happened last weekend and everything we've learned in the ensuing days. Former Boston City Councilor Tito Jackson is here in Studio 2. Thanks for joining us, Tito.
Thank you for having me.
And Joan Donovan, Research Director at Harvard's Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy, is with us on the line. Thanks for joining us, Joan.
Great to be here.
Okay, Tito, I'm going to start with you for a minute, and I am going to take us back to last Saturday.
They rip children from wombs and sow a ground beneath your feet to foreigners.
Nazis out of Boston! 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 Nazis out of Boston!
Tito, how'd you find out? Where were you and what went through your mind? And what goes through your mind in hearing that sound?
So I was in the city of brotherly love and sisterly affection down in Philadelphia. And I began to get text messages and a couple of phone calls, and obviously switched on to the Globe and the Herald. And for me, this is one, a show of where we are at as a country, as a people, and as a union. And it's a real decision point that individuals on the 4th of July, the day in which most a tribute to freedom as a black American. Obviously Juneteenth is that day for me. This is something that is something that we have to, as a people, address. And as a black person, you also don't get to address this in a vacuum. So Jaylen Walker was also shot 60 times this weekend.
In Akron, Ohio. Black man.
Yep.
Police stop.
Right, and this is and Robert Crimo, just recently shot
Highland Park shoot.
And so the component in question here is parity. I don't believe that
P-A-R-O-D-Y or P-A-R-I-T-Y.
That's a really good question. I guess I would simply say to you, are we treating people the same? And If I think Mr. Morrell brings up a really important point. As a black man, if 100 of us were marching down the street and assaulted someone, would there be a delay in stopping the whole group, arresting the whole group, and figuring out what happened? And so, these are issues that are now being thought of and addressed with the Boston Police Department. I would say the encouraging piece for me, though, is that U.S. Attorney Rachel Rollins and Mayor Michelle Wu, FBI Special Agent John Bonavolanta, and ADL and ACLU, all in the room with community members addressing this issue. And I don't know that room existed 11 years ago when I first got on the city council. But this is a reckoning in the city of Boston. And it'll be interesting to see if those individuals ever come back. And if they come to Ruggles Station, right. If they come to Jackson Square.
Versus Oak Grove out in,
Exactly. Or Dudley Square. So they understand the demographics. And they understand the play in which they're involved in.
Okay, so I'm going to turn to Joan Donovan in a second, but to pick up on a thread, we have some sound from U.S. Attorney for Massachusetts Rachel Rollins appearing on Greater Boston Wednesday night, echoing this theme about parity, P-A-R-I-T-Y.
There is a real tension between certain communities, and this is what we talked about today, the mayor and myself and other law enforcement partners, where there are certain communities that feel like they are surveilled and watched constantly, and then other communities, you know, even though these individuals might not be from here per se, but that have the freedom to show up and march without any sort of questioning or altercation.
So I want to make it clear to listeners, the reason, Joan, that we brought you and we brought Tito together is there's kind of at least two dimensions that we're trying to dig into here. One is what happened in the city, the context of race, the city's response, et cetera. The second is a hate group that came to the city, what we know about hate groups, how they organized, whether they should have been known to us in this plan, et cetera. Tito helps us a lot with the first. Joan, this is your research on the second, but I'm just going to start by asking you to react to everything you just heard, anywhere you want to go.
Yeah, I think, you know, when we think about what these groups are trying to prove when they show up to a city like Boston, which is incredibly multiracial, and like Philadelphia, perhaps known for a bit of our warm confrontation. What they're trying to do is create content. They're trying to create situations in which they can create viral videos. The uniform look of the participants that is coordinated so that they look strong and disciplined together. And we've seen Patriot Front do this in a number of different cities where they show up in a U-Haul and all jump out together and march with the drums. And so this to me feels a lot like 2016 when we saw the rise of the alt-right. And of course, Patriot Front was part of that rise of the alt-right. And there had been a fissure within that movement about what it meant to do physical protests and to be present in public space. And Patriot Front has decided that these flash mob gatherings are going to be the most advantageous to them for spreading their message through violence and then, you know, having a prominent website online where people can go and learn more. And so, unfortunately, this is something that we're going to see repeated many times in many different cities until police figure out a way to confront them and stop them from doing it.
So there's a lot there. I think the first thing I will pick up on, I'm going to play a little more sound here from U.S. Attorney for Massachusetts, Rachel Rollins, on Greater Boston Wednesday, about, you said, you know, there's a prominent website where people can go and learn more. Let me just play some Rollins sound.
This organization itself, Patriot Front, NSC 131, yeah, they are actively working to be covert so that they will not be infiltrated. They will not be stopped by law enforcement. We saw in Idaho, though, that there were arrests that were made, and some of those individuals are here in Boston as well.
So first, Patriot Front and NSC 131 are different organizations, both prominent as far as white supremacist organizations in Boston and Massachusetts go. That sounds different than what you said, Joan.
Yeah, no, what they're talking about isn't necessarily the message that these groups want to put out in public, but rather their organizing style, which with Patriot Front has gotten more and more clandestine over the years. They used to use gamer chat apps like Discord to get organized. That had been infiltrated by a set of activists, several of which were from Boston, who would publish their communications. So these groups have now started to go further and further into encrypted messaging apps to plan these events. And what we know from some of the video when they were leaving Oak Grove is some of the license plates were from different states, including Texas. So it's not the case that many of those people live here, although undoubtedly some of them do, because we did have the organization right at the beginning or earlier than the pandemic of those straight pride marches. And those did reveal that there were some of these white nationalist folks organizing here in Boston. One more famously has been arrested in the January 6th insurrection, who's from Malden, which is very close to where Oak Grove is.
I think actually a couple, right, from Super Happy Fun America.
Exactly. And so these groups are often intertwined, and the naming of them is really, performative in many senses. They're all here for a very similar outcome, which is they want to put white identity on the map and they want to put white nationalism on the political agenda.
And that to me is one of the things that really strikes at the consciousness and from a safety perspective, things that mm-hmm. folks in the Black community really are thinking about and on folks' hearts. So we have many places of worship. I go to Union United Methodist Church. Shout out to my pastor, Pastor Jay. We are the one church that I know of, the one Black church that I know of that has performed gay marriages. And so, thinking about the safety, which is actually our church is not too far from there. Reverend Willie Broderick, who you often feature, who's an amazing leader in the city of Boston at 12th Baptist. What is the state of play for safety? And we have seen Black churches attacked. And so that is one of the things that, some of this sounds to be performative, right? But when it comes down to the actual safety of Black and brown folks, people from the AAPI community, the trans community, and diverse communities in the city of Boston, that is another component that we all need to think of. And I do again, feel that there was leadership shown by Attorney General, U.S. Attorney Rachel Rollins, as well as Mayor Michelle Wu, by pulling people together into the same space and place to address these issues. So that's a really important thing. And as noted, this piece around how police can deal with this. Well, there was an assault. We know or alleged, let's even say alleged assault. So that gives the police an opportunity to do something that they oftentimes wouldn't do based on issues around First Amendment. So we need to kind of think about how these individuals who are holding shields, by the way, who knew not to bring those shields on the train, which they didn't, so someone actually took them from them, and also these individuals who parked outside of the view of cameras, when they went to Oak Grove. So there's a lot of coordination that is connected here. And I also just think it's an opportunity for us to come together as a city. And this can't only be Black and brown folks and people from diverse communities. This is an opportunity for white allies who many people called call 311, 911, and the like in neighborhoods that are not predominantly people of color where they march through. So that's a start. And I think we can come together as a city and lead and not follow on these issues.
We're talking to former Boston City Councilor Tito Jackson and Harvard researcher Joan Donovan as we dive beneath the headlines of the white supremacist march last weekend in the city of Boston, but that certainly shook the region. Joan, Tito just talked a lot about safety issues, what we can do to protect people, what we need to do, who is vulnerable. I want to pick up a couple of things on that, and I'm going to start by playing a little bit of sound from a press conference on Tuesday. This is FBI Special Agent in Charge Joseph Bonavolanta.
Hate speech can be at times covered by the First Amendment if it rises to a level where there is a threat or use of force or violence. That is where we can and have gotten involved and initiated investigations.
So I'm going to parse that out a little bit. We had current Boston City Councilor Ricardo Arroyo on the show Wednesday, picking up on Tito's point and saying when there was an alleged assault, that changed what the police could have done in the moment, which is detain people to question them about a possible crime that it had been alleged happened. But we also have heard this week as events have unfolded and people have talked about it, tensions around whether or not to surveil a group like this in advance because there are freedom of speech issues, et cetera, and that you've got to wait till after a crime has happened for somebody like the FBI to follow. I know you've probably followed all those threads, Joan. So the question is, what do you agree and disagree with? And what must cities and towns be doing, recognizing this is coming and there are vulnerable populations who are physically at risk as a result?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have to definitely think about, and I appreciate Tito's intervention here, because it's Black communities tend to be the targets of this, these kind of hate groups where they, you know, will go and leave messages or the stickers. And it's definitely a more subtle form of intimidation. And then what we see is these groups, you know, really want to show and get media coverage for their actions. And so we have to wonder about when they're doing this and why. Of course, Patriot Front attacking LGBTQ parades and whatnot is also something that we've seen last month during Pride Month. So it's really important that we understand that vulnerable groups that are put under such stress, I mean, we have to think about what happened in Buffalo as well. Here in the context of Black Americans thinking about, well, if I'm just doing normal everyday activities and I'm at risk for this kind of vigilante violence, who is going to protect us?
Doesn't that mean it's working, Joan?
It does. Psychologically, yes, it does create a culture of fear, a culture of looking over one's shoulder. But in the communities that I circulate in, it also creates a form of solidarity where we depend less and less on the state for protection and more on each other. And it's what's been interesting over the years in terms of infiltration of Patriot Front groups is that there have been activists, anti-fascist activists for years that have been tracking their movements. The reason why some of these more recent events have caught people off guard is because Patriot Front is getting better at organizational security. That is to say that they're becoming more disciplined. And that's where I think it's going to be really important for police to start to step in. And this is very this is national. You know, you have these groups traveling between states in order to do this. Some of it is free speech, but when violence happens, which in many respects is intended as part of the show of force, they crave that kind of confrontation. You know, that's a reason why the state should begin thinking about, well, how am I going to keep track of what we might end up now having to develop policies around, which is domestic terrorism. One thing I want to bring attention to, because the Patriot Front website does record all of their actions and show what cities they've been in. And they have a list of all their activities, and in Massachusetts is the second most active state. So Patriot Front is very active in Texas, second in Massachusetts, third in Virginia, fourth in Connecticut, and fifth in Pennsylvania. So you can see that this is something that where the membership is dense, like in Texas and Massachusetts, those are the kinds of communities that we're going to have to look out for and protect and double down on understanding these groups' intentions and actions.
So Tito Jackson, hearing researcher Joan Donovan there talk about that, a couple of things come into my mind at once. One of the reasons we specifically wanted to talk to you is that you were active in the protests after the murder of George Floyd in the summer of 2020. And somewhat locally, famously, in front of the Boston Police Department station during a tense time between marchers and police officers. Joan said a moment ago, you know, police need to intervene. We've had some argument from local activists this week that the police don't want to intervene. Now, I want to say that the law enforcement has said that their concern was looking like they were escorting a white supremacist group if there was an accompaniment, that there was concern about optics. Pick those threads for us for a minute.
Yeah. So, you know, it's one thing to do good, but you also must be seen doing good. And in this regard, I think there could have been another action here. And I would submit to you as a middle-aged black man, when I was a young person, I've been in groups and actually sometimes not actually in the group, and I've been stopped.
You mean just in proximity?
In proximity. And I didn't do anything. And so in this case, there was an opportunity here. And so we need to kind of think through that. And mind you, I also understand this kind of perception component around the Boston Police Department not wanting to look like, hey, we're going to escort these guys down Boylston Street. And I think that would also be problematic. But I think it is very important that, one, people are in the room, connected, having these conversations with one another, which I do think is happening. But I think we have to put in context. You and I had a conversation prior to the show. Ironically, Common Ground Revisited, which is a play about a book by J. Anthony Lucas.
About busing in the early 1970s.
In 1970s. The play was ending the same day. And so that's and there's a backdrop, and I don't have time to discuss what Common Ground is, but people who are from this area definitely know.
Well, so, we covered it. We'll put a link to the story that we covered it that explains all this on our website at radioboston.org with this feature.
And there's a backdrop, and there's some teasing in that play about where do we want our future to go, and really, are we in the same place? And
I would say that we were in 1974.
In 1974. That is a question right now. Are we in the same place? But the most important question is, where are we headed and how do we get there? And I think the way that we do that is together. This is where a word that I didn't have when I was a young person called intersectionality, where people who are not necessarily the folks who are in the line of fire are able to come connect with and have each other's back when it comes to what is going on in our city. And so it is really critical that communities as a whole, and not only communities of color, not only our LGBTQIA communities, AAPI communities, that we come forward as a show of force and say who we are as a city of Boston. And we are a city that is, I believe, about turning to each other, not on each other in these difficult times, as my former boss used to say. So we have an opportunity right now in this moment. And this is the question is, what would you have been doing in the civil rights movement? What would you have been doing in Nazi Germany? Where would you stand? And you know what? Thinking about what that used to be, you have an opportunity to stand in the right place today, to do the right things today, to speak out, and to stand up for what is right in this time, because that is literally what we are facing in the city of Boston and the United States of America in 2022.
And Harvard researcher Joan Donovan, back to you just briefly, kind of for a last word on this. Tito Jackson just laid out a bit of a blueprint for what must happen in communities in response to the moment that we're in. I mean, I have 52 more questions. If we could go 3 more hours, there's so much more. But in this short moment, what I do want to ask you is, based on what you've learned, what do cities and towns have to do when white supremacy bursts to the surface in this type of organized way in order to keep it from continuing to happen?
I mean, it's sad as it sounds, we have to stay vigilant. We have to look for some of the earlier warning signs. Sometimes that involves making sure that we know what's happening online and what these groups are planning. That would be something that the role of the state could play. But more often than not, it's citizens that are going to notice these changes in their cities and areas if they start noticing stickers and other kinds of paraphernalia, things that mention Western civilization or taking the country back. Those are signs that there are white nationalists in your area and in your neighborhood. And we've started to see flyers being placed on people's cars and on people's driveways. So we are in the midst of this group of people waking up, becoming more organized, wanting to become more public. And I have no doubt it has to do with elections coming up, as well as the desire to cause this kind of violence and create this fear in communities. And so it's going to be important that churches and other people build those networks and question what it means to find these stickers. They can always, if they see things up in their neighborhood and they don't understand them, they can always take a picture of them and send it to me on Twitter. I'm happy to see if it has anything to do with any of these movements. But yeah, that's the community is the solution here.
And quickly, your Twitter handle, Joan?
Boston Joan.
All right.
So I accept, you know, these kind of images and also really cute cats and dogs. So animal fan.
And we will not be moved by cowards in khakis. That's not happening.
Oh, goodness.
In our time. These are cowards, and these are individuals who didn't want to wear a mask during COVID, but have no problem wearing a mask right now. We're going to stand up as a city and as a people and show that the city of Boston is not going to have this.
All right. Tito Jackson is former Boston City Councilor and CEO and founder of Apex Noir Cannabis. And Joan Donovan is Research Director at Harvard's Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy, and an expert on extremist organizations. You both are always good to the show. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.